When you walk into O'Brien's Wines, take confidence from the fact that every one of the wines you see on our shelves comes directly from a winemaker we know personally. We choose quality so you can choose what you like. Our exceptional wines start from less than €10. We'll see you in store or online at obrienswine.ie. O'Brien's, only good choices. Please enjoy alcohol sensibly.
Never Have I Ever with Claire Byrne, a News Talk original podcast.
Sponsored by O'Brien's Wine. Try something new.
I asked for a doctor's kit for my third birthday. You hear the noises, you hear the ventilator, you see their tiny little heart beating, and you're just like, how is this heart beating? I don't sit still. I have sofas in my house, but I don't sit on them.
You're not shouting at people, but no. Still you're managing to put the fear of God into us that we might do something wrong when you're around.
If you are an ambitious, intelligent and resilient woman, there is no career that you can't do. My mum thinks they're building the children's hospital for me.
Never have I ever.
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 There are certain jobs in the world that I genuinely cannot imagine doing. Air traffic controller, bomb disposal expert, perhaps, and surgeon is right up there near the top of that list, because I just don't think I have the temperament to even watch surgery, never mind perform it. There's the smell, the pressure, the blood, the guts, the precision of it all, and the idea that one tiny mistake could change somebody's life forever. No, thank you. And then there's pediatric surgery, which somehow feels even more unimaginable. Tiny babies, tiny organs, tiny margins for error. I think most of us like the idea, though, that when something goes really wrong, there are these extraordinary people who step forward and know exactly what to do. But I've always wondered, who are they? What kind of brain lets you stay steady while holding a child's life in your hands? Never have I ever observed a surgery. But Jennifer Billington has, and much more, and she's with me today. Welcome to Never Have I Ever, Jenny.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you with us. I mean, when I say that and much more, your social media bio describes you as surgeon, baker, Irish dance teacher. So we've got all of those things to talk about. But I just want to talk to Jennifer, the surgeon, first. What is it that you do? Describe it to me.
So I am a consultant neonatal and pediatric surgeon. So what that involves is I operate on any baby from the point of viability. So that's a kind of contentious subject in itself, but it's around 22 or 23 weeks of gestational age. So about the size, maybe 400 or 500 grams, all the way through to 16, 17 year olds, mm-hmm. and everything in between. So that can be emergency operations on their bowel. It can be babies that are born with problems so that they're, for example, their organs may not be formed in the correct way. Kind of elective general things like lumps and bumps and hernias. And then I also work in a major trauma center. So we look after people that have major road traffic accidents, falling off horses, knife crime.
So when you meet people first and you say that that is what you do, what is the reaction that you get?
I think people are quite surprised. I still unfortunately think that despite the prevalence of men and women in medical school, there's more females in medical school now than men. There's still a tiny proportion of consultant female surgeons. I think people are generally surprised, and I'm usually mistaken for someone who's not the surgeon. So I could be mistaken for the physiotherapist or the nurse or the dietitian. And even if I say I'm a surgeon, people will often forget that. And then they'll say, well, who are you again? And they'll be quite surprised.
So interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And why do you think that is, that there are so few consultant surgeons at your level when there's equal billing in medical school?
I think there's probably a couple of things. I think that traditionally women have probably shrunk themselves to not be part of environments they thought they probably didn't belong. And I feel very strongly that jobs should never be defined by gender, male or female. And if anything, that drives me more. It drives me more that it's a more challenging road. And I think it's an opportunity for women to kind of expand their potential rather than anything else. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very demanding career. I think it expects a lot. And I think women have more to juggle with in terms of family life, children, their career path may take longer. But the other way I look at that is that it's a job that gives back so much. And if I had a pound or a penny for everyone that told me, oh, don't become a surgeon, you know, women don't become surgeons, it's been told to me more than people that have encouraged me to do it.
Nice.
And that really kind of drives me to hopefully inspire the next generation that, you know, you see a young person will see you in your scrubs and maybe their views of what they're capable of will expand because of that.
Jennifer Billington spends her days operating on babies and children at King's College Hospital in London. But what interests me isn't just the job she does, it's the person behind it. Jenny travels home to Bray every month to teach Irish dancing in the same hall where she learned as a child. She loves baking, dreams of writing a cookbook, and says her way of relaxing is doing more. Fancy cakes, big renovation jobs, supermarket food hauls, you name it. Then she goes back to work, where every millimetre matters and every decision could change a child's life. And if you're one of the many people waiting for Leaving Cert results this summer, stay listening for Jenny's story. It's a powerful reminder that one set of exam results doesn't have the final say on the course of your life. I can't imagine doing what she does, but hearing why she does it and what it means to her is something I'll never forget. So just looking at the Never Have I Ever theme, like, I can't imagine doing what you do. I can't imagine watching you do what you do. So what do you say to people who would feel faint even at the prospect of being in that room watching you work?
So I love people coming to theatre. So I will always say if someone wants to come to theatre, my only thing is that you have to meet the patient beforehand and you've got to be on time. They're the two kind of prerequisites. And that goes for anyone coming to theatre. So like my secretary has come to theatre because she wanted to see what these operations are about. So she's come to watch. And we have lots of medical students. We've got lots of people that are still in secondary school actually that come for a taster week. And people faint all the time. Like, I've never fainted, so I don't really understand how it feels. But there's obviously a smell, there's the environment, it's hot. People are nervous, they don't know what to expect, and some people are quite squeamish. So I, at the start of my day in the brief, I always find out who's who, you know, who are the students, who are the visitors, who are the observers. And then I always say, like, if you don't feel well, sit on the floor because you can't fall further than the floor. And I always mean that. Like, if someone looks peaky, I'll be like, sit down on the floor. And then people don't want to sit on the operating floor. But I'm always like, you can't fall further than the floor.
And tell me about that insistence that they meet the patient beforehand. What are you thinking there?
I think that's going to be on my headstone when I die. Honestly, it's something that I talk about to every single person I work with, because I think when people look at surgery, they think it's, you know, bright lights, bravado, ego, and you're doing an operation and everything's great.
TV drama.
Yeah. And, you know, there are elements of that that are true. But like, you know, if you think about a baby, that is a family's most precious possession and they are giving you their child. Some people don't have any option in an emergency, but they're giving you their most precious possession. And I don't think there is a greater privilege in this life than operating on someone's child. But that privilege, in my opinion, starts before you ever go near an operating theatre. So one of my golden rules is that, you know, I will never operate on a child if I haven't met them or their family. Now, there are some circumstances where I might not be able to, but if I am able to meet the family or their child, I will have met them before the operation, because it's so important. If a family trusts you, and that trust starts before an operation, your relationship with them is better. Your patient has better outcomes. You have a journey that is so much more easier, I suppose, because, you know, you don't want to meet a family for the first time after an operation if it hasn't gone to plan.
Yeah.
And I feel you have to have that buy-in and that they understand that you're compassionate and you have empathy before you then operate on their child. And that's something that I have never changed. It's something I decided to do in my training, and it's something that I continue to do this day as a consultant.
Can you remember the first time you did a major surgery? What was it like?
I can. I remember my mom actually asked me, what did it feel like? You know, like, what does it feel like? And I don't think there is a word. I think it's somewhere between fear and focus and a bit of gratitude. I don't know. But I remember the story is so clear. I had just become a consultant and, you know, I had done lots of operations, obviously, on my own before becoming a consultant. But it's different when you're a consultant because you are ultimately responsible, whether it's a good outcome or not a good outcome. I got referred a baby that was I think, 26 weeks gestation. She was about 600-700 grams, so tiny. And she needed an emergency operation on her bowel. So they brought her to hospital. So she came from a different hospital. Her mom was really unwell in intensive care. So this mother had never met her baby. And they came with their dad. And I met the dad. And part of this meeting the family beforehand, I get to have usually quite difficult conversations. And I think it's really important that they understand who I am before I operate on their child, and that I'm able to kind of communicate very difficult information in a clear way. And, you know, I said to him, I said, you know, there's a 50-50 chance that she'll survive. And I said, and there's a 50% chance that she'll die during the operation or afterwards. But if she doesn't have an operation, she won't survive. And I remember just like, I meet so many vulnerable parents, but in those moments where you're just with the dad and they're kind of split between their partners in a different hospital, their brand new baby is here. And he said to me, he said, will you promise me that you'll try and save her? And I said, I promise you I will. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, why did I say that? You know, because I didn't know she was so sick. And he's the last thing he said to me, he said, this is our 10th attempt at having a baby. And I said, oh my God. And he said, we've never had a live baby. They had lost every other baby beforehand at different stages. And she said, this is our last chance. And I was just like, oh my, you know.
Pressure is mounting by the minute.
Yeah. And, you know, when the babies are that small, you operate in their incubator. So, you know, it's not the bright lights. It's not the ego. It's not busy. It was midnight. It was me and my assistant. And then there was the anaesthetist and some of the doctors that were on the neonatal intensive care unit. And it's so simple in that you lift the roof off the incubator, the theatre comes to the baby, you have a portable light and you operate in their cot on the neonatal unit. And it's interesting because the world becomes so quiet. Like you hear the noises, you hear the ventilator, you feel the warmth of the kind of the thing that blows hot air on them, and you see their tiny little heart beating and you're just like, how is this heart beating despite everything that's going on? And being able to do the operation, you know, there's a really fine balance of like, you know, the gloves feel too thick and the instruments feel too big because these babies are just the size of a pint of milk. And, you know, I know that what's needed to fix this baby. So my hands, the instruments, it's a really fine balance of doing too little or too much, and too much can damage the baby. So I suppose that you're kind of constantly in a state of fear and focus, and it's somewhere between the two of those. But
did that baby survive?
She did, yeah. And being able to go and speak to the parents afterwards is when things go to plan, it's almost like disbelief, I would say. I wouldn't say I feel joy or triumph. I think I just am like, I'm so happy that it's over, and there's gratitude that the baby has made it through. And to be able to tell them that the baby survived is an incredible feeling. And they are the moments that I find the most difficult. It's not the difficult conversations.
Really? Why is that?
I feel I've been very well prepped and trained to have very hard conversations. But I'm able to really keep it together in those conversations because I think that's what the family need. But when something goes to plan and you just feel so much gratitude that it has gone, I always go through the plan A, plan B, plan C.
So do you find it difficult to be professional? Do your emotions
really,
come to
really
the
chokes form? Me, yeah. When I go back and say, like, and that mother, I rang her in, she was in intensive care and the dad was there. And I remember I was just so choked. I do manage to hold it together, but I find telling people that everything went okay, I just find that so special. And that little girl actually ran into my clinic last week, and she's now 3.5. She's in creche. She's amazing. She's developmentally normal. And like, to know that at that moment, I suppose I was part of, you know, they trust you with their child today on the worst day of their life.
Yes.
And they trust you with their tomorrow. And you don't know what comes after tomorrow. But to know that I was there for that moment, like, it gives you back victories throughout their life. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a job satisfaction that's very, very hard to explain.
I wonder what the theatre is like when you're in charge. I feel I should say that I know you outside of this.
Disclaimer.
And we're going to tell people why when we get there. So I have an inkling as to what it might be like, but I want you to tell me.
So I am a perfectionist. I always have been a very competitive person. But I suppose my perfectionism, it's kind of, as I kind of touched on it before, like, it's about the whole journey of being a surgeon. It's not just turning up and doing an operation. And that's kind of how I kind of run the show, I suppose. You know, I'll never be late. If I'm late, there's a problem with the train or there's a problem with me. But I will have usually told someone. So I'm always on time. Everything is very organized.
Like, get cross with people who are late?
I try not to. But if someone was late and they missed the theatre brief or they hadn't met the patient, then that is an opportunity to reflect on being present earlier. And I usually will do the operation in that situation.
Opportunity to reflect. Yeah. I wonder what that sounds like.
And then I think the other thing is I'm very particular about, obviously, like, precision is a huge part of what we do, but like being delicate with touch but even things like, you know, the room has to be symmetrical, the bed has to be symmetrical, the patient has to be in the middle of the bed, they can't be crooked. I will mark all of my incisions with a marker before I begin because I don't like a crooked scar. My favorite thing to do, obviously I love operating, but I love the very end, like making sure that the wound is beautiful, all the steri-strips are lined up perfectly and that the dressing is perfect and the baby is clean or the child is clean. So when they go back to the family, like, they judge you on all of these kind of like really superfluous things that actually have nothing to do with what you've done inside.
But you're judging, it sounds to me like you're judging yourself. Absolutely. And you're holding yourself to such a high standard. Yeah. That's a lot of pressure though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I love it. And I just feel like that the devil's in the detail, Bats. And I say that inside of medicine and outside of medicine, that it's another thing is that we call it like human factors. So they're kind of like your non-surgical skills. And people that's what I aspire to try and have excellent human factor or non-surgical skills. And that's like, you know, that you're approachable, that you've got good communication, that you turn up on time, that you speak to your families. Like, it's all of that, the things that go around the operation, that you're statistically more likely to have better outcomes. You're more likely to pick up complications. People are more likely to speak up if they feel comfortable in your presence. And also just being like modeling good leadership and being a good role model, because that's ultimately what's going to inspire someone.
When you walk into O'Brien's Wines, take confidence from the fact that every one of the wines you see on our shelves comes directly from a winemaker we know personally. We choose quality so you can choose what you like. Our exceptional wines start from less than €10. We'll see you in store or online at obriensWine.ie. O'Brien's, only good choices. Please enjoy alcohol sensibly.
Was there any tradition of medicine in your family? Where did all this come from?
There isn't really. So my dad was a paramedic. There is obviously some medical stuff there, but the rest of my family are not. So I'm one of four. Nobody else has chosen medicine. I didn't know any doctors in my life. I never knew a surgeon and never met any doctor until I went into medical school, actually. But my dad and my mum owned a medical supply business when I was younger. And they had this like shop in the Dargle Road in Bray, and they sold like stethoscopes and syringes and bandages and stuff, first aid kits. Like, I was quite a, unsurprising, I was quite a vocal child. I'm a twin, and my twin is like the polar opposite of me, like really quiet, quite reserved. And I asked for a doctor's kit for my third birthday, and I always knew I wanted to be a doctor. And I didn't know I wanted to be a surgeon, but from a very, very early age, I knew I wanted to be a surgeon. And I didn't want like a plastic kit. I wanted a real deal. So I got a real stethoscope and bandages and, you know, plastic syringes, no needles, obviously. And I never let anybody else be the doctor, which is, you know, looking back, I'm like, oh God. But my sister was always the patient or the nurse, but she was never allowed to be the doctor. And it kind of just continued from there, yeah.
So it was sort of one track, was it?
Yeah, I never ever wanted to do anything else. I loved cooking and I loved baking, but I always knew that I wanted to go into medicine.
But it wasn't a straight road into medicine for you. It was tough.
I think it's probably set me up to have the work ethic that I have now. And I think I'm 39 now. So what, that's 21 years since I did my leave insert. I still have nightmares about my leave insert. That's the only thing I have recurring nightmares about. And I was in school and I used to love parent-teacher meeting days. I was a really good kid in school. And my mum came home one day and she said, you know, your biology teacher said that she doesn't think you're going to get the points for medicine. I was in fifth year. I was just so upset that someone would say that about me. And I just was like, I just carried on. So I didn't get the points for medicine the first year. I missed it by 60 or 70 points. So I came out of school and I went into Tesco and bought my stationery to start again. And I didn't party. I just got on with it. And I kind of knew my parents divorced when I was 14. So my mum kind of single-handedly raised us from then. And she put me into like a local school to repeat my leaving cert. We couldn't afford the kind of fancy, you know, going into town to do it. But I did a local school. And when I sat it the second time around, I missed it by 10. And that broke me. Like, I was 19. And she says to me now, she said, I would have chopped off my leg just to give you those extra 10 points. And we appealed one of the papers. It was my geography paper, and it didn't go up on the appeal. And there was a contentious issue, but my teacher felt that it was worth, you know, I definitely was going to go up. So when it didn't go up, I was kind of at this point, I had reluctantly started a biomedical science degree in UCD, which I hated. And my mum said to me, she said, like, why don't we just go to Athlone and appeal it? And I honestly have to thank her for that, because my sister was 9 at the time and she drove us down to Athlone, and I was 19, and you got given the marking script and you got given your paper and you had to basically mark your own paper. That was the October, so a fair while after the Leaving Cert results. And at the bank holiday weekend in November, I got a call to say that I had won the appeal and that I got the 10 points.
I'm just imagining doing that as a, what were you, not, were you 19?
Yeah.
19?
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have had the confidence at 19. Maybe I would have if I felt so strongly about it, but yeah, that's a lot to ask of somebody at that age to sit down and to argue your case.
Yeah, yeah. I think I was at a point, I think, where I was so defeated, I just thought I was going to get it and I didn't. And my mum, if it wasn't for her, I'm not sure I would have had the kind of emotional resilience to kind of push myself to get it. And she spent the afternoon on the phone on the Friday of the bank holiday weekend ringing around, and then they found out that I got a space in the Royal College of Surgeons. It was too late for me to start because it was November, and I had to wait a full year before I started. So
what did you do for that year? Did you get a job?
No, I worked in a bakery, and I think that's probably why I love baking. And I started the following September, and I genuinely think, like, I know everybody works hard, but I really appreciated my place. And I worked so hard in medical school, and I graduated pretty much the top of my class. And I'm so proud of that, because I think it just shows that, like, you can have setbacks, and if you have the support and the belief that you absolutely can overcome them. And I think that has driven me forward.
Would you became a consultant very early as well?
Very quick. Yeah, I would say the average time from kind of leaving medical school to becoming a surgery consultant is probably in the region of about 15. Some people could be 20 years. It just depends. But I was a consultant. I graduated in 2012 and I moved to London a year later. And then I did 8 years of surgical training and I didn't stop. So some people will, you know, do research. When I applied for my training with pediatric surgery, it was a 12-1 competition ratio. So I just was like, I'm not going to get it. So I applied for a master's in Imperial and I got both of them, and I decided to do them together, which it was a very tough 2 years, but it was 9 years to the day, pretty much, that I left medical school that I became a consultant, which is so young. I was 34. I'm not saying I would recommend that to everyone, but that's just kind of the way my path went. And I just operated solidly for 8 years. And yeah.
I know you love the job and you love where you're working now.
Yeah.
Is Ireland on the cards for you in a professional capacity coming back?
Well, my mum thinks they're building the children's hospital for me.
I love how she has such
a belief in you. They're building it for you. And I'm like, no, they're not. Honestly, I'm not sure if it's ever going to open. But I think at the moment, my kind of work-life balance in the UK is excellent. And the training I've had is amazing. It's definitely not a never. But I feel that if I was going to come back, I'd like to come back with a few more years under my belt.
Okay.
Because I'd like to drive kind of change and, you know, just continuing to push things forward. And I think in the infancy of your consultant career, you're still kind of finding your feet and finding what you're really passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't feel that the right time is now.
So medicine was always going to be for you. Then surgery was always going to be for you. Just when I think about, you know, never have I ever been in an operating theatre. The fact that it's pediatrics is another layer, because the babies are so tiny, as you've described. Like, was it always going to be pediatrics, or when did that come into the picture for you?
I always, as you say, I always had an affinity to surgery. I don't know, was it like that there was a science and a skill? And I think I loved the idea of perfecting something. And I am very kind of, as a person, ambitious. I'll always choose the hard option. But I think I definitely gravitated towards pediatrics, definitely in medical school for sure. And then I learned that it was, like, you know, super competitive. I think I had a natural kind of draw towards it. But I think as the more I understood about pediatrics, I'm like, it's the only job that kind of gives you the opportunity to be involved in someone's life really before it's begun. And you have the opportunity to change the course of that person's life. And I don't think any other specialty gives you quite the same satisfaction and, I suppose, victories. Our victories are not necessarily, you know, the surgery went well. It's like, you know, the surgery went well and they're in creche and they've gone on a school tour and they've got friends and they have a birthday party and, you know, all of those victories. And a lot of our patients, they will stay with me until they're 16 or 17 and then we'll decide, do they need to go into adulthood?
You have oversight over them.
Yeah.
But just when you describe operating on a premature baby, I'm thinking about my hands if I was doing that. Like, they'd shake.
Yeah.
Do your hands shake?
No, I don't. My hands are so steady.
I can't thread a needle, by the way. So that's where I'm. That's my starting point.
My hands are very steady. You don't have to have the steadiest hands in the world.
Did you learn that? Is that? No, that's just you. Okay.
Not every surgeon I know has got steady hands. But I think it's more about how you use your hands. I know that I'm on a mic, but I have tiny hands.
You do have tiny hands.
I'm in the smallest glove size that you can wear. So I feel that that's like a secret skill for me. But I think it's how you use your hands. And, you know, when I'm operating on tiny babies, like quite often I won't use instruments. Obviously, you have to use some, but they're so fragile. Like their skin is almost translucent. And I keep talking about operating on babies, but that really is my favorite part of the job.
Why is that? Why are the tiny babies? Because I'd imagine that's the most challenging.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm coming at this from a complete layman's point of view, but that is really difficult what you describe, but it's your favorite part. So why?
I think the stakes are so high and I think there's a real balance of exactly what is going to hopefully save or fix this baby, i.e. the instruments, the hands, the detail, the precision. All those things are also the thing that could damage the child. And it's about mastering that skill of being able to get it right and, you know, not putting too much pressure and how to put the perfect stitch in and what's not a perfect stitch. I think that's like a lifetime's work. And going through training, I think I was very hard on myself. I'm a perfectionist and in the middle stages of my training, if I wasn't able to do something, I think if I found something difficult, I would equate that with not being capable. And now I realize that it's okay to say that something's difficult just because it is. And it's not because you're not capable or you're not great at your job, but actually you can be in a very difficult situation. And I think having insight into that is really important. But also, you know, being a great colleague is also really important. So, you know, I might not be doing an operation, but I might be in theatre. Like, for example, yesterday I was in theatre all day. I wasn't operating, but I was just there watching, supporting. Mm-hmm. And I had an interest in being there. And I think being a great surgeon is also about being a great colleague so that someone can pick up the phone and ring you and ask you what they think is a stupid question, because there is no such thing as a stupid question. The only thing is a stupid question is the question that's not asked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I pick up the phone and ring people all the time, and I equally would like people to do the same for me.
So you're always pushing yourself to try and learn how to do the things that you find difficult or that you can't do. But do you accept that there are things that you cannot do?
I think within surgery, I'm really passionate about minimally invasive surgeries. That's keyhole surgery on babies and robotic surgery. So I've recently just done a robotics course on operated on pigs, actually, on live pigs, which is a whole other weird thing. But it's the closest thing you can get to operating on a baby. But keyhole surgery in a baby is very, very technically difficult. But if you can do it, it's amazing. So if I didn't feel I was good at something, I would challenge myself to get better at it. We do a lot of practice outside of the patient. So we've a lot of simulation and stuff that you can self-practice. But yeah, I would say that's one of my character flaws, is I don't like not being good at something.
Mm, just has an awful lot of pressure on yourself all of the time.
Yeah.
But do you like that?
Yeah, I do. It doesn't feel like I do, actually. I think it's just kind of, I kind of have this strict set of what I work and live by.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't really feel like pressure because I'm constantly roughly aiming for the same thing all of the time. And it's kind of a cumulative skill, isn't it? You know, you get better with time. So that, as I said, the operation is one part of the whole package of being a surgeon, actually. And I think the other stuff is the bit that people forget about.
Mm-hmm.
But with time, people will get better. So if you do a couple of 1,000 operations, most people will be quite good. That's what I think anyway, but...
You're listening to Never Have I Ever with me, Claire Byrne, the podcast in which I meet people who've done the things that I've never got around to, or I'm just really curious about, or just plain afraid of. And this episode is definitely a case of fear, because I really don't think I could stand in an operating theatre and watch surgery on a tiny baby. So if you've been listening to the podcast over the past few weeks and thinking about which of these challenges I should take up, please don't suggest this one for my sake. I'd still love to hear from you, though. What are the things that you've never done and why? What's on your bucket list? Do send me an email. The address is never@newstalk.com. Right, Jenny, are you ready for some rapid fire questions?
Yeah.
Okay. I mentioned earlier, as well as a surgeon, you're also an Irish dancing teacher, a passionate baker, a home cook, some home renovations in there as well, just to keep us busy in case there's any downtime, any chance of downtime. And I want to talk more about those aspects of your life as well. And some of these questions will relate to those things. So let's go. Your biggest operating theatre ick is what?
When people cut my steri strips for me because I like them to be in a straight line.
Okay. What's the worst thing to hear in an operating theatre?
Definitely the crash bell.
That's the one that causes people come running. Alarm.
Yeah.
What is worse, blood or vomit?
Vomit. 100 times worse than anything else. If someone vomits, I will run the other direction. You won't see me.
Really?
Yeah.
I think we assume, people who aren't in the medical profession, that all bodily fluids are okay.
I honestly don't mind anything else but vomit. I just, my siblings were travel sick when I was younger and they used to just vomit everywhere, and I don't need a psychologist to tell me why I don't like vomit.
Yeah, so. There's a particular smell as well.
Yeah,
and it's just not good. Do medical students really faint in operating theatres, or is that just on the pit and ER?
Definitely faint, yes.
They do?
Yeah.
Do they question their life choices at that point?
Definitely, I think, yeah.
Are they wise to?
Sometimes, yeah.
Are surgeons secretly adrenaline junkies?
I would say for the most part, probably. I'm quite risk averse, actually, but I do love a good busy day. You know, like, not crazy, but I love like a good stream of complicated, difficult things. I get real buzz off that.
Who is more competitive, a surgeon or an Irish dancing teacher?
Irish dancing teacher.
Great. I love it. I can't wait to talk to you in more detail about that. Which is more stressful, surgery or a big Irish dancing competition?
Surgery.
Who's more intense, surgeons or Irish dancing mums?
I'm going to have to offend you and say Irish dancing mums.
More to come. You're trapped in a supermarket queue. Because you're a big fan of shopping and baking and home cooking, are you judging everybody's trolley?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm like, who needs 700 bottles of water? Or I always have a good look. And then I typically recommend things as well in the queue to people. I'm like, look at this. And I can't help myself.
Which requires better precision skill, stitching or icing a cake?
Stitching, but I do think that it's good transferable skills. So stitching helps with other aspects of my life for sure.
That makes complete sense. The overlap, I think, is interesting between what you do professionally. Well, you do both professionally, really, don't you? Surgery and the Irish dancing, because there's the discipline, the timing, the repetition, the perfectionism. Do you think that they both feed the same part of your personality? Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think so. I think I danced from the age of 5, and me and my sister danced the whole way up. My mum was quite, you know, wanted us to be good at it. And I became a teacher, never thinking that I would actually teach, because I knew that I was going to go into medicine. And my sister and her husband set up a dancing school in Bray. And I wasn't a part of it initially. And my husband, when he moved over to Ireland for university, he came to our dancing school when we danced. And they paired us up because we're both tiny and we were 2 and partners. And it was 18 years ago. And so me and my husband obviously live in London. But as was the turning point, we were intermittently involved with the class. But the turning point was in COVID, actually, where we gave free lessons to all our kids for 2 years. And we took over the online component and taught for 2 years. And we just couldn't step back at that point. Mm-hmm. So
at this point, I'm going to fess up about our connection.
Yeah.
So my daughter goes to your Irish dancing school, Jane, and she's been there for a couple of years. So I sort of know that side of you. And I can see the perfectionism. I can see all of that. But something else I see is that when you're there, because you teach from London on Zoom, and then you're there in person, regularly enough, actually.
Yeah.
But the dancers stand up taller when you're there.
Yeah.
the parents stand up taller when you're there. I'm a bit more conscious of like the hair being right and the outfit being right because Jenny's back.
Yeah.
You've never told me off once. Like, I don't get that from you. So what is it, do you think, that you have that authority? Because you're not shouting at people, but still you're managing to put the fear of God into us that we might do something wrong when you're around.
I think, that's put very nicely. I think the devil is in the detail. And I said this before, and that goes for everything. And I'm really particular about like the detail in Irish dancing. So like the fine things, the fine corrections. That also can be like, you know, how someone is presented. You don't get marks for how you look, but certainly, you know, the hair needs to be perfect and the dress needs to be lovely. And I think I've got high expectations for that. And I think anyone that has spent time around me will know that I'll fixing hairs, fixing costumes, making sure that everyone's socks are the same level. And I just, it's that attention to detail. I think it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. I suppose I'm trying to get to the root of what the authority is that you have, where it comes from, because yes, everybody is kind of, you know, a little bit more nervous when you're around.
Yeah.
But then when something goes wrong at a competition, I have seen you bring a child away to the side and speak to them really kindly.
Yeah.
And I have firsthand experience of this when something goes wrong.
Yeah.
That child never comes away feeling like they're in trouble or that they can't go back and do it again or that the world has ended. In fact, they feel really good about themselves.
Yeah.
So how do you manage to have them feel the fear, but they want to please you at the same time? Is it conscious?
No, it's not. But I do know what you're saying. Like our co-teachers will often say that, you know, when me and my husband come back, that, you know, everyone will up their game a little bit. And I suppose it's probably a change in routine for them. Probably they observe my life and hopefully they witness, you know, someone who works really hard. I think I have a very high expectation of like, you know, you got to put in hard work and no matter what to hopefully get results. You don't always get results when you put hard work in. And I think being gracious and being a kind person can go in parallel. You can be soft and steel at the same time. And I think that's probably what I go for with surgery. And I think my job allows me to contextualize a bad day at an Irish dancing competition. It doesn't, you know, in the grand scheme of the world, it's important just to take a step back and say, do you know what? No matter what, when you're 60, you'll probably say, oh, I used to Irish dance when I was younger, and you'll still have all your friends, but you won't actually remember what happened on that day in 2026. And I think it's being able to just take a step back from that. And we have a very kind of strict policy of there's no negative talk on a competition day. And I don't think it brings anything positive. So it's all about just kind of looking after the young person and making sure that they're okay and kind of getting them through the day.
Yeah, but you're a judge as well.
I am, right? Yeah.
And I know nothing about Irish dancing apart from the fact that my daughter does it and I have to carry her bag and her bun wig and try and get it all right. Okay, so I'm just there as sort of like almost a neutral observer, but you can't be in Irish dancing.
Yeah.
And I think it's a kind of, it's an unfair sort of a thing, Irish dancing, because it's really subjective. So it's what you like, what the other judge doesn't like, mightn't be what you like. Mm. Can you rationalize it for me?
I think I was just thinking about what you said about trying to figure it out. I suppose one part of being a surgeon is that like I get to advocate for, you know, very, very vulnerable people in work, as in my patients. And I get to really advocate for them and their life and their future. And I take that with such responsibility. And I love that part about my job. But I think equally in the Irish dancing world, I also want to advocate for every pupil that dances with us. And I really want the best for them. So maybe that's why people, when I'm coming home, they're like, oh my God, I need to, you know, that they know that like I want the best for them and I want to push them to be their very best. Because I think I was pushed by my mum and my husband as well. Like if I ever have a challenge, they will be the people that just rile me up and push me through it. They'll never talk me down. So I think it's probably a bit of that. And as a judge, it's the exact same for me. So I try to smile at dancers when they come out because I think they're so terrified. I want to sit at that table knowing that I gave everyone the best chance and I advocated for every person that danced in front of me. So I am a very fair adjudicator, but I suppose my style compared to someone else's preference, it's kind of like fashion. Like, you know, do you like this designer or that designer? Do you like this style or that style? And there is a huge amount of subjectivity and that can be really tough.
Yeah,
because, you know, you're dealing with children's hopes and dreams and that is their world and that can be really hard to witness. Mm-hmm. So I think my twin always says this to me. She said, like, you always kind of bring me down to earth. If someone has like a disappointing result or something happens, you know, I just say like, it's not the end of the world. It's a really annoying thing to say. And I remember when I didn't get medicine, someone said, oh, this character building stuff. And I remember thinking that is the worst thing you can say to someone when they're literally their hopes and dreams have been dashed in front of you. But I think with time and maturity, these things do pass. And I have so many friends and a husband because of Irish dancing. And
were you a champion Irish dancer?
Yeah. Since the age of 9, yeah. And then I danced up until I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
But the memories for me are my team dances. It's not solo memories. Of course, there are solo memories, but it's the friendships that you make. They outlast any competition.
Yeah, and I can see that. But you know, when you say, you know, you shouldn't say to somebody, oh, this is character building, I totally understand that. But I do think it builds a resilient Absolutely. Child.
Yeah.
Because, okay, it's unfair some days and it doesn't go your way. But the resilience that you build as a result of that
Absolutely.
Is something else. You can't buy it.
Absolutely. And I think that for anyone that, as I said, I don't think any job should be defined by a gender. But I think if you are an ambitious, intelligent and resilient woman, there is no career that you can't do. And I think I really want to instill resilience in not just dancers around me, but like people in my life, you know, that I didn't have an easy road to get where I've got to. And it's okay to say that you became resilient along the way. And to know that you put in the work and it might be enough, but it might not be enough. And it's okay to be disappointed with something, but still recognize the journey and recognize that you've grown as a person. And I think resilience is probably the greatest thing you can give to someone. And anyone that dances in our class knows that the thing that's probably the most important is it's not about winning graciously. It's about actually not winning graciously. So, we always say like, if it's not your day, it's somebody else's day. And that's going to be the best day of their life. And you don't want to be the person that's, you know, the corner of their photo crying or, you know.
That's really hard though, because if I've worked really hard and want to cry.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
But I'm not allowed to do that.
And I think there's a time and a place. So we've had many a conversation about people, you know, trying to dust off the tears before they go on stage for a presentation. And I always say like, it's okay to be disappointed with your results, but somebody else might have given anything to stand where you are. So it's just reminding them of how to contextualize winning and not winning. Like,
yeah.
I don't like to use the word losing because, mm-hmm. you know, I meet families all the time. They just would want their child to be healthy. And if you have a child that's healthy and able to do something, well, that's just amazing. And if you've got a child that's able to do something that they love and they're actually brilliant at it, I mean, it's more than so many families could ever dream of.
You're not teaching Irish dancing and judging Irish dancing to relax.
No.
That's not relaxing. I refuse to believe it's relaxing.
No. Well, see, For me, I think that's one of the things that helps me switch off. I never switch off fully. I always think about my patients. I'll always have patients that are recovering from surgery. I have access to notes 24/7 on my phone. So you never fully switch off. So I can always check in to see how they're doing. But I do find that when I sit down to teach, or not sit down, but when I go to dancing class or I sit down to judge a competition, like as kind of going back to advocating, I really give it my all. And I do find that those are moments of kind of mental calm for me.
Mm-hmm. So is the baking then and the cooking, is that switching off?
Yeah. So I don't sit still. Like I have sofas in my house, but I don't sit on them. And there's too much to do in the house, but I...
Is Sam, your husband, like this as well? Or is
he's
the same as you.
Oh my God,
I feel anxious and stressed.
No, so he's the calm. So I am a hothead, quite fiery. Not that I'd lose my temper, but I'd definitely get annoyed about things and I would be partial to swearing, and he just never swears, never shouts, has never shouted at me. But he's so competitive. Like, he's so competitive and he's so ambitious. And I've met a lot of people that men and their partners are medics, because he's obviously an actuary, and they're not really that supportive of someone being a non-traditional role within medicine, shall we say, or surgery. But he has just been behind me 1,000,000%. Like he's moved around with me, he's moved to hospitals with me. And if I ever think I can't do something, he'll be like, don't be ridiculous, of course you can do it. Together, I think we're we're dangerous in that we're landing ourselves in difficult renovations and house projects. But I think we really thrive off that. We really thrive off a project and doing hard things.
Mm. So is the supermarket a favourite place for you? Because I see on social media you do, this is what I bought today. And I get so sucked into this.
Oh my God, so many people are obsessed with shopping hauls.
I love it, but I love supermarkets as well. I love it. And I'm always like, what chocolate did Jennifer buy today? Yeah. What vegetables? What's the ratio of vegetables to nice things here? It's great. I'm obsessed.
Yeah. So I think people, like social media kind of allows people to have an insight into people's worlds. And it's just fascinating. It's kind of that endless kind of scrolling. I don't like social media for a lot of reasons, but the trolling side of it, I really dislike it, which is why I'm usually a face away account. I don't really do lots of videos of us because I just think it invites not nice comments. But things like food halls and shopping halls, people are obsessed. They just love to know what people buy. And I love going to a supermarket. I will never do an online shop. Like I don't understand it. I love to go to a supermarket and I sometimes I'll write a list, but usually I don't. And I kind of just wander around and I'm like, oh, I like the look of this and I like the look of that. And then I love cooking and I love slow cooking. And if I've had a really difficult day, I've got a very good energy level. So I don't, like I do love sleeping. So that's a very misunderstood part of me. People think I don't sleep, but I love sleeping. I sleep a minimum of 8 hours a night, but I mentally unwind with cooking or dancing.
What makes you scared or what are you fearful of? Is there anything?
Yeah, I'm really afraid of dying. Yeah. It's not how I die, but I think like what happens to me after I die. Like I really, really dislike talking about it. And I just, like, I don't mind talking about it now, but like, you know, all the things that I've worked for in my life, like where am I? Where do I go? Even though I deal with death quite a lot.
Yes, it's so unusual to hear this from you.
Yeah, I just think of me, maybe it's a selfish view, but I'm like, what's going to happen to me? Where am I going to go? And that's the thing that...
Where does that come from? Do you know?
I don't know. No, I don't know where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
No.
So I'm saying never have I ever done what you do. Now on so many fronts, I understand, you know, Irish dancing and being good at baking and being a surgeon. Are there any never have I evers for you that you can think of off the top of your head? Something that you have never done that maybe you'd like to try?
There's two things that I was only thinking about this the other day. So I never learned to play a musical instrument.
That surprises me.
Yeah.
Because you have a very musical ear, right?
Yeah. So I would love to be in a trad band. That is like a weird thing. And I'd love to learn to play the fiddle, but my husband informs me that it's too late to learn to play the fiddle. I think he's just saving his ear because it's like me trying to play a fiddle. He is an amazing musician. So he plays the piano, the flute and the piccolo like extraordinarily well. And I can't even read a piece of sheet music. So I'm thinking maybe the Bowron because it's like more rhythmical, but I would love to be in a trad band. And the second thing is I think I definitely will do this. I could do both, but I definitely would like to be a cookbook author. Like, obviously, I've written medical papers, not loads, but I do like writing and I would love to write some cookbooks.
Mm-hmm. I think you'll probably do both of those things. In fact, I have no doubt that you're going to do both of those things. So having had our conversation, and I've told you how squeamish I am and, you know, that my hands shake and all of the rest. Could I even stand and watch you do what you do? Do you think I'd be able to do that? Would you make me sit on the floor?
I definitely make you sit on the floor, but we might start with like some, you know, there was lots of online videos of operations. So we could start with a practice run, sit you on the floor.
Yeah, I can't even watch the gory bits. I have to turn away and ask my children when it's over.
So now we record everything because everything's keyhole. So there's hours of footage. So we can arrange a movie night if you want.
Okay, I might start there. Jennifer, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Never Have I Ever with me, Claire Byrne. You'll find a new episode every Wednesday morning on the Go Loud app or wherever you stream your content. Please be sure to like and follow the podcast or leave a review. We love your feedback. You can also email me at any time. The address is never@newstalk.com. Never Have I Ever is a weekly podcast from Newstalk. The producer is Tom Donnelly. And don't forget, you'll find The Claire Byrne Show every weekday morning from 9, live on News Talk Radio and streaming on the Go Loud app.
Never Have I Ever with Claire Byrne, a News Talk original podcast.
Sponsored by O'Brien's Wine. Pour your heart out.